It cannot be proved with mathematical precision, but I am equally sure that the Johnsons, the Bangs sisters, Mrs. Rhett, and Mr. Kaiser obtained no information about me in any underhand way. The phenomena that occurred negative such a supposition. Mediums of large practice and high psychic power are proverbially forgetful of what has occurred in their presence. Even if they wished to do so, they would find it impossible to recall the personalities of a thousand or so spirits which manifest to their clients in 1 year. And, if this be true in the case of people in their own country, how much more difficult must it be to recall what has happened to casual tourists? They are, moreover, indolent people, who never write a letter or send a telegram if they can avoid it. As to telegrams, the cost is equal to their fee for a sitting. Knowing that I was in the country only for a short time, and not likely to return, why, in the name of common sense, should they communicate my movements, or the intricate particulars of my sittings with them, to other mediums whom they might suspect I was going to visit? If they did so, how would it forward their interests on my next visit years after? In each city there is a small group of ladies and gentlemen who investigate on proper lines. The group in one city do not know those in the next. So offensive is the attitude of the average American to the subject of spiritism that, as a rule, the real investigator keeps his studies secret, not so much that he fears ridicule, but because he knows that an open avowal of his belief in the supernormal would weaken his influence in public affairs. It was owing to the kindness of these American investigators that I saw none but the best mediums. Some wit has said, there are three stages in the evolution of every new discovery, -1, it is all lies, 2, it is the work of the devil, -3, we knew all about it all along. America is in stage 1, Great Britain in stage 2. And the curious part of the business is this, the secret lies in America. Only those psychics born in the States, and brought up in that electrical atmosphere, are endowed with sufficient psychic power to induce discarnate spirits to make the effort to manifest clearly and efficiently. They may be able, as in the case of Danholm and Mrs. Rhett, to exercise their gift in England, but it generally does not last as in their own country. But, to return to the subject of collusion between mediums, let me illustrate my point. How could the Bangs sisters know I was going to put them through tests? How could they know what sort of picture I required? They knew it was my guide, but nothing more. I had not even a photo in my pocket, as I had in 1909. The whole arrangement of the sitting for the picture, the attitude, locket, chain, and dress, had been settled between Iola and myself at Detroit by means of the direct voice. The skeptic of the S.P.R. type would say, oh, yes, but, of course, Mrs. Rhett wrote these particulars to the Bangs sisters the day before. Did she? Listen to the following episode. On the afternoon of the first day, January 28, the face of Dr. Sharp appeared for a short time on the mottling canvas, as stated in Incident 99. Lizzie Bangs then said, I am impressed by Dr. Sharp, pause, he says he wants to straighten out something, pause. It is about the money paid for his picture. We are to let you know that we told Mrs. Rhett to say, if anyone asked her, that she paid us $30 for that portrait. We sat for nothing, but we were so pestered by mediums asking us to sit, as fellow psychics, that we wished it known we were not willing to exercise our gift, without payment, for them or any other people. Note, 1, 2 years previous to this, 1909, the Bangs sisters told me they had sat for the portrait of Dr. Sharp some years before, free of charge to Mrs. Rhett. 2. No allusion whatever had been made to Dr. Sharp or his portrait on this visit, 1911. But, about a week before the above message from Sharp to Lizzie Bangs, I had asked Mrs. Rhett, in her drawing room at Detroit, how much did you pay the Bangs sisters for that beautiful picture of Dr. Sharp? She replied, $30. I said, that is curious, they told me that they sat for nothing. Mrs. Rhett looked very embarrassed, and the subject was changed. When the impression from Sharp was blurted out by Lizzie Bangs, I was delighted, thinking I had received a magnificent test. That evening I wrote to Mrs. Rhett reporting what the Chicago medium had said, and feeling sure she would corroborate the story. I met her on February 3rd. Imagine my astonishment when she gravely announced that the story was untrue. She said, "Admiral, if that had been so I would have told you, for I do not tell lies even for the convenience of the Bang sisters. I paid, as I told you, $30. It is true that this sum is less than they usually charged at Lilydale. Some pictures they sat for, of the same size, were $45. I ask, does this look like collusion between Mrs. Rhett and the Bangs sisters? Dr. Sharp, who invariably expresses the greatest regard for the Bang sisters, said, spontaneously, when materialized on February 3rd, at Johnson's, Delado, it will be straightened out about the price of my picture." And when I asked him again, on February 7th, at Detroit, he said, "Those poor girls, they have so much to do, they have forgotten. This is very probable, neither of the sisters has a good memory." Incidentally, I may state that the picture in question is the best precipitation I have ever seen which has been accomplished in the presence of the Bangs sisters. As a portrait I can say nothing about it, but as a work of art it has a value far exceeding the modest sum paid for it. I take it to be worth at least $100 as a painting. Two in my possession are nearly as good, they cost me $35 each. I have had them appraised here as colored copies of photographs, and the lowest estimate given is $100, £20. They are both in this book, but the black soft hyphen and white reproductions from carbon photos give no idea of their intrinsic worth. Anyway, that is not the question for the moment. I had not mentioned one word to the Bangs sisters respecting the money paid by Mrs. Rhett for the picture. The impression given voice to by Lizzie Bangs came to me as a great surprise. I can readily understand that the old spirit control, who is devoted to his medium, and has, at the same time, a great regard for the good work done by the Bangs sisters, was troubled about the talk he had heard between Mrs. Rhett and myself, and endeavored to put it right. What the truth of the matter really is was no business of mine, and it was not in my thoughts on January 28, 1911. I now turn to another symptom of absence of collusion between Mrs. Rhett and the Chicago psychics. Iola and I had arranged at Detroit that the portrait was to be altogether a spirit picture. This would mean that her hair would be loose. Now, it so happened that I afterwards regretted this, and mentally desired that this feature should be somehow avoided, for I could not fancy it would look well. As I have described in Chapter 9, the sisters saw the form clairvoyantly. At first, the hair was loose, again I mentally objected, and the clairvoyants saw it drawn back behind the head, one saying, "She sees you do not like the hair loose, and she has arranged it differently." So differently did she eventually arrange it that it might now be mistaken for the most modern style of hairdressing. There is a wreath of flowers on the top of the hair which conveys an association to me, but which was, so to speak, not in the program. Though anxious to thrash out anything which may be said by way of normal explanation, I cannot find in my notes one tittle of evidence which would show that the Johnsons and Mrs. Rhett corresponded with one another, or that the Bangs sisters corresponded with the Johnsons or with Mrs. Rhett. What has led to some confusion on the part of novices as to collusion between mediums is this: spirit controls of different mediums do meet one another from time to time, and, I have no doubt, exchange ideas and information on the other side. If the mediums have met, they achieve this with great facility. But, instead of this fact being brought forward as testimony against the truth of spiritism, it is really one of the best evidences in favor of it. Detroit is nearly 60 miles by rail from Toledo, and about 45 miles in the direct line. The habitués or familiar spirits of Johnson's cabinet manifest occasionally at the seances of Mrs. Rhett and Kaiser. One of the best instances of this taking place which I have given in my public notes was the speech of Johnson's control, Grey Fever, on February 11, 1911, during one of my private seances with Mrs. Rhett. Speaking in practically the same voice as is heard when he is making use of the organism of Johnson, and at a time when Johnson is laid up, he reminds me of the origin of his medium's illness ever since he hanged that paper on wall, an incident of which Johnson had spoken to me at least twice. Mrs. Rhett's seances are self-convincing. There is no necessity to tie her up, or gag her, or torture her in the various silly ways adopted by pseudoscientists. She can only speak one language, Yankee. She is physically incapable of enunciating pure English or the jargon of the red man. No sane person could suspect her for one moment to be personating Iola, Greyfeather, or any of my English spirit visitors. Correlations are numerous throughout my notes. Hudson carries messages to Rochester from Chicago and Detroit, and makes himself known to me coherently at the three cities through three different psychics, who are unknown to one another. Iola refers, in Mrs. George's script at Rochester, to a particular incident which had happened some days before in the seance room of Miss Ada Bisnett, though these two private psychics know nothing of one another. At Detroit she frequently mentions events in which she had participated during sittings with Mrs. Georgia, the Johnsons, and the Bangs sisters. She helps to precipitate a picture in pale lavender dress at Chicago. I inquire of two controls at Detroit, and find this is the proper color for the sixth sphere, seventh realm. It is this position which she has always asserted she holds in the spirit world. She is able to tell me at any time what I have been doing, and shows an intimate acquaintance with my life, my friends, and my wanderings, which is nothing less than astounding. She relates to me at Detroit the explanation of a series of incidents which occurred 50 years ago, of which I was only partly cognizant, and brings three other spirits who corroborate her story. I am at a seance with the Johnsons at Toledo on a Saturday afternoon when Cleopatra manifests to me, and says, "I am going west with you." On Sunday evening Cleopatra appears to May Bangs, with whom I am sitting at Chicago. There was no time for a letter to arrive, even if the Johnsons felt disposed to write one, which I am sure was not the case. Greyfeather, the control of Johnson, manifests at Mr. W. D. Stead's country house in England, where Mrs. Rhett is a guest, identifies himself, and assists in her circles. Remember, this Indian is not Mrs. Rhett's control, and has only lately visited her seance room at Detroit for the first time. While in England his talk is not confined to subjects with which he is familiar in America, he gathers information from Julia and other spirits, and makes a very decent show of acquaintance with English affairs. He also manifests through Kaiser in Detroit. At one of my private seances with Mrs. Rhett in Mr. Stead's country house, Grafy there came to me, and, speaking distinctly, said, "Chief, I come only when you are here. The big top-knots, eminent men, in your country no like Indians. Gladstone, he see me, and say, 'Get out,' and that admiral, your friend, he come and say, 'Greyfeather, be off.' Q, who do you mean, Greyfeather? A, I mean admiral from Portsmouth. He here now. I bring him to you." Then a distinguished officer identified himself to me who had died suddenly 3 months before at Portsmouth. We talked of many things. I asked him if he had a dislike to Greyfeather. His reply was, "His manner is very abrupt." The spirit control uncle refers at one of Husk's seances to seeing me the previous day at a sitting where Williams was the medium. John King, Sir Henry Morgan, Husk's principal control, takes charge of the physical phenomena at the seances of Mrs. Rhett in Mr. Stead's house and greets sitters, whom he has known at Husk's circle, by name. Abdullah, one of Crack's controls, manifests at two of Johnson's seances in Toledo, Ohio. I will conclude this subject of correlations by the narration of another incident that occurred at one of my private seances with Mrs. Rhett in England. On June 10, 1911, my guide spoke to me for some 30 or 40 minutes. Among other things she said, "I came to your cousin here the other day, and spoke to him of his father and his relatives in Canada." Q, what name did you give? A, the spirit here gave one of her earth names. I wrote to the said cousin, who told me that he had attended a seance with Mrs. Rhett, in the same room, nearly a fortnight before. A spirit came and gave her full name and her sister's name. She alluded to her picture. He could make nothing of it. This gentleman was born 6 years after the death of Iola, and had never heard her mentioned in the family. The names he gave me were all correct, and one of them was the name by which Iola was called by his father, one seldom used by the family. There were six names in all. The efforts of bona fide conjurers should never be despised by investigators into spiritism. If they can pick up a fraudulent medium, so much the better for us. Provided they relate truthfully what they have seen and how they account for it, they cannot possibly do any injury to genuine psychics. Unhappily, they cannot all confine their mystifications to the stage, but carry their legitimate deceptions into private life, where they are not legitimate, and they often weaken their influence by committing themselves at the first start to theories of fraud before they have witnessed the phenomena which are the basis of discussion. When a man comes on a stage and says, "Here, ladies and gentlemen, you see I have nothing on me," and then pulls three or four rabbits out of his coat-tail pockets, he is performing a perfectly legitimate action. But if the same man that evening writes a letter to a friend, and says, "I assure you I know that those mediums you saw are arrant knaves, and he has not been within 4,000 miles of them," he is simply lying. He cannot know, for he has not been to see. He may answer, "So and so told me," but that is no reply to his correspondent, who has witnessed the phenomena under conditions which preclude fraud. The effects of conjurers' explanations are not all one-sided, they can confirm our experiences in a very practical way. I will give an instance which happened to myself. In the summer of 1909, a report came home that May Banks had been in the police court at Chicago, and had denied that pictures were obtained in her house by any occult process. I do not, as a rule, believe anything I read in American newspapers, but this report was in the Progressive Thinker, a journal devoted to the propagation of spiritism. I knew the editor, and his opinion of the picture and letter phenomena of the Banks sisters. He believed them to be genuine. It was impossible to ignore such a report emanating from his office. I confess I was for some months considerably mystified. I entered into a long correspondence with a conjurer who claimed to have discovered the secret of the production of the precipitated pictures. He must have thought me a very apartment pupil, for he proposed to me one day that I should write a book of what I had seen, with his explanations as to how the thing was done. I should think nearly 100 letters passed between us. He finally convinced me that he knew nothing whatever about the subject. Then he reproduced the effect on the stage, crudely at first. But, after praiseworthy effort, very satisfactorily. The principle I already knew. It was found out by a spiritistic friend by means of my own models. The conjurer's conditions were as different to the conditions of the seances of the Banks sisters as a locomotive boiler is different from a teapot. He did his best. But his efforts and explanations settled me in the conviction I have already mentioned. The question of the so-called confession of May Banks was finally clinched by the discovery that the report in the Progressive Thinker was incorrect. Abundant proof came to England that the psychic did not deny her gift, and so the matter ended. The point of my story is that it was a conjurer who finally convinced me that my 1909 observations with the Banks sisters were genuine spirit manifestations. His inability to account, normally, for the phenomena, to my satisfaction, made it possible for me to return to Chicago in a confident frame of mind. I may have to say a word or two about American conjurers before this book is published. This chapter concludes the account of such facts as can be stated publicly, which led to my knowledge that the immortality of man was a reality, that it was possible for us now and here to communicate without great difficulty with the next state of consciousness, and that death, like sleep, was a mere incident in the evolution of the ego. Chapter 12. Conclusions. My tale is told and a duty discharged. I have other evidence which cannot be made public. Indifference as to success or non-success of book, new ideas take long to assimilate, truth will prevail at last. Training of the author, 60 years ago he would have been considered mad. Abraham Lincoln, a spiritist, seen at the White House. Lincoln interested in physical phenomena as well as mental. Longfellow, a spiritist. Resignation, the five foolish questions. What is the good of it all? The resurrection hymn, the American Civil War. The Bishop of London, no consolation to be found in the churches, one objection to Spiritism not to be ignored, the Roman Catholic doctrine, what that church demands of her children, man his own savior, tolerance in the present day for different forms of worship, Archbishop McGee on the atonement, the resurrection of a supernatural being no encouragement to man, why beings in more than three dimensions cannot explain their occupations to those in three only, time a mortal conception, examples of activity of beings who function in more than three dimensions, several curious queries and reflections, replies to them, exaggerated grief of survivors has a bad effect on spirits, laughter in the seance room, the spheres and realms, the first attempt to rise resembles the hell of Christian theology, breaking of the golden rule, realms distinguished by colors, evil spirits have not the knowledge of vibrations sufficient to do physical harm on the earth, dangers of Spiritism, Sir James Simpson, ministering spirits, benefits of Spiritism, is it right to recall spirits? Proofs only given to a few, thousands deterred from relating their experiences. The greatest sensitive, Sir Lewis Morris, the arguments of the churchman no answer to materialists. My tale is told, the narrative of my education is finished, and a duty is discharged. In 1904 I was led to the task of investigating Spiritism, in 1911 I have completed my studies, and am satisfied of its truth. If I never see another psychic again, the evidences I have obtained are enough to make me sure of the future. I shall go to my grave in the conviction that in a brief space, a few days, I shall awake in the possession of the same individuality that was mine before breath left my body. In my records I find certain contradictions and many inconsistencies which I do not understand. That is inevitable. Differences of opinion exist in the next state as well as in this. Communication with those on the other side is not so simple a matter that we can expect to have all our questions answered clearly and distinctly, as if we were dealing with the dwellers in a state of consciousness that knows of only three dimensions. Those we appeal to for information tell us frankly that they cannot reply to many queries on account of our very limited powers of comprehension. You cannot understand these things until you come over is a frequent reply to interrogations. I find, however, that there are certain general principles running through all the items of knowledge vouchsafed to me, which teach me that the Christian eschatology, as at present interpreted, is very much in error. The question will, no doubt, be asked, is this, which you have related in your book, all the testimony that has brought you into knowledge of the proximity of discarnate spirits and the persistence of your personality after bodily death? No, reader, it is not. I have better evidences in my notebooks than anything I have put in print, thousands of private messages interwoven with the public matter submitted to you. I have also hundreds of narratives earnestly related by men and women of all shades of intelligence and religious belief, concerning their experiences. These are all of a private character. The world is not right for a general declaration of all the glimpses which diligent investigators enjoy of the world to come. It is unwise of any man to give out to a doubting crowd the sacred details which constitute his most cogent reasons for the faith that is in him. As long as 9/10 of the inhabitants of the civilized world are in the unprepared, ignorant, and priest-ridden condition they are now, such revelations would be productive of more harm than good, for they would, even in England, elicit anger, contempt, and ridicule. It is not the duty of an investigator to provoke such a result. His function is to state, as clearly as his idiosyncrasies allow, all that he has seen and heard, apart from family matters and intimate conversation with friends, and leave the consequences to those who read his account. It is not his business to concern himself with whether his readers believe him or not, nor to enter into any sort of propagandism. I am sure that those who read my book will acquit me of discourtesy if I tell them that it is a matter of indifference to me whether they credit what is in it or not. If they do, it will prepare them for what they may experience themselves if they go forth on the quest. If they do not, it only indicates that they are not yet in that condition which enables them to assimilate new idea. There is plenty of time. If they reject my experiences as inconceivable, their children and grandchildren will not do so. Catcher is a judicious mother, She does not intend that new truths should be assimilated quickly. The fact that the world is round was known to the few a thousand years before the Christian era, but many centuries had to pass before this truth was accepted by the inhabitants of the West as a whole. Indeed, there are people who pass as intelligent in England who do not believe it today. I have met one at least. Again, centuries passed before it was generally believed that the earth moved round the sun. The ebb and flow of disputation has at last convinced the masses that such is the case. Spiritism has been in the air for 4,000 years at least, but not yet has the time arrived for it to be fully assimilated. It will come more quickly in Great Britain than in America, but in neither country will it take deep root for many years, perhaps not before the end of this century. Backwards and forwards will flow the tide of belief and the ebb of angry denial until, after many long decades, a general agreement will be arrived at. It is not in the public interest that such revolutionary facts should be easily believed. Imagine what would happen if all the inhabitants of the British Isles were suddenly to come to the knowledge of what is in store for them, and how near to them are the relations they have loved and lost. Hosts of men and women would be running to mediums, and leaving their legitimate occupations for the excitement of the séance room. Misery and hopeless destitution is the unhappy lot of hundreds of thousands in this country. They cannot, in their opinion, be worse off than they are. Why not cut the slender cord which binds them to their present life, and risk the evils of the next, with hope of reaching a state of happiness hereafter? No. Nature abhors these sudden earthquakes in the continuity of evolutionary changes. My publication is a duty, but it will be productive of little apparent good. Years hence, other travelers will return from faraway countries charged with electrical conditions such as exist in North America, and will tell of pictures they have seen precipitated, forms they have seen materialized, songs they have heard sung by invisible people, and voices they have listened to which gave them definite information of public and private importance. In that day there will be more people than there are now who are prepared. They will look back into the records of former investigators, and find that a poor old gullible naval officer, who had ceased from his professional labors, once saw and heard the same curious phenomena. This will make them think, can these strange sights and sounds happen to two, or more, men who were unacquainted with one another, and who lived at different epochs, without there being some truth in what they have related? More investigations will follow, let us hope, on more sensible lines than obtain in the present day, and there will be more acrimonious discussion. Conjurers will, of course, have their pickings. But the final result is certain: truth, however long deferred, will prevail in the end. Spiritism will be accepted as a fact, and will profoundly modify the present ghastly conception of death and the day of judgment. When a man sets out to describe events outside of ordinary human experience, he is in duty bound to give some account of himself. If he does not, those who read his narrative have a right to question his powers of observation. And, the more remarkable his experiences, the more necessary the justification he is bound to show that he has, at least, the same natural powers of seeing and hearing as the average professional man or man of business. At the age of 16 I entered the surveying branch of the Navy, and remained connected with the hydrographic department of the Admiralty, in some form or the other, for 35 years. When I left I had commanded 6 surveying vessels, and had been in charge of 5 surveys in the Pacific Ocean, Australia, China, and on their coasts of Scotland and England. The life of a nautical surveyor is one long training of the powers of observation. There is no profession where so much is required of the eyes, very few where so much is demanded of the ears. The human eyes, looking straight in front of an observer, take in with more or less precision all objects within an arc of 160 degrees. Those within 80 degrees can be seen with considerable accuracy. It is the business of the explorer to note what he can see at a glance within this arc. It is he who achieves skill in this line who succeeds in the art of chart making and the collection of notes which go to make up the information required for the navigation of ships which follow him. If he has not good sight for long distances as well as short, good natural powers of observation, and of noting what he sees with accuracy, he will fail in this particular profession. I did not fail. I do not claim that, in walking about the street, the nautical surveyor or explorer takes into his cognizance more than the average man, but I claim that in any special quest he does do so.